This is the DTV Digest, the podcast that brings you news and reviews of films which didn't make it to the cinema. And now, here's your host, Mike Parkin.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the DTV Digest, the podcast which brings you reviews of films which didn't make it to the cinema and instead went straight to DVD, Blu-ray, or streaming media. I'm your host, Mike Parkin, and joining me this week are Richard Hawes.
Hello, everybody.
And Stephen Lockridge.
Hello, everyone.
For a moment, I thought we'd lost you. In tonight's episode, we're going to kick off with Ruby Rose and Jean Reno in The Doorman. Then we're going to look at the new horror creature feature called Yeti. Then the indie horror called 12 Hour Shift, which did very well in the festival circuit last year, so it'll be interesting to talk about that. Our short shot this week is going to be Ready. And in our DTV throwback film I'd never ever heard of before called The Cold Light of Day. So without any further ado, let's crack on. Our first review then is The Doorman. Following a tragedy while on active duty in Romania, Ali returns to New York and is set up with a new job by her uncle as a doorman in a wealthy apartment building. While the building is undergoing some renovations, it reveals a number of surprises, including hidden treasures, secret rooms, Ali's deceased sister's family residing there, and a group of armed thieves. Okay, so this stars Ruby Rose. It's directed by Ryuhei Kisamura, who did things like Azumi and...
Versus,
that's right. Midnight Meat Train, I believe, was one of his as well.
Yeah, Godzilla Final Wars.
And Final Wars, yeah. So, you know, a very dynamic filmmaker, usually. Rogue that we covered last year, Ruby Rose is very good in sort of the main role, but possibly a bit too young for her character, I believe. But she handles the action well. We've got Jean Reno as the main bad guy, and this wonderful building that they get to play in. Rich, over to you.
Yeah, so I like this quite a lot. It's much more of a throwback to 90s action than I was expecting, because it is basically another one of those diehard inner movies.
Yeah, it sure is.
So this could have easily come out in, this could have easily been 1992 or something. It's got that kind of, it's got kind of a rapid fire kind of feel to it, sort of that era, you know, the early 90s.
Yeah, it's got the classic setup, isn't it, where they, you know, the bad guys have gone to great pains to clear the way into the building so they can just, you know, have the whole weekend to do what they need to do, and she's the fly in the ointment that you know, in the wrong place at the wrong time, you know, in the classic tradition, basically.
And also in the execution of it as well, as I think it feels, the whole thing feels like it's an older movie, not necessarily a new, I mean, obviously it's got that sheen of a film that's made in 2019 or 2020, but it's very solid, much better than I was expecting. I mean, you've got a filmmaker like Kitamura, you expect a certain amount. You kind of think, oh, it's not going to be that great because he's working on a much lower budget. But I could easily see this film as a theatrical release, not necessarily now, but in the 90s. Yeah. It's certainly comparable to films made of that period. And there's some really nicely put together stuff. So at the beginning, there's a fantastic match on action cut where she's blown by an explosion, and then it cuts seamlessly, obviously with computer effects and that added in, to her falling into her bed.
I kind of knew I
was in safe hands from that moment on. I was a bit cautious at the beginning because the film does, now correct me if I'm wrong here, but the film seemed to do the thing which I hate, which is introduce the cast on the screen, but then the title doesn't appear, and the title only appeared at the end of the movie. So that drove me crazy because I'm just waiting for the moment that the title's going to appear, that stress in me is traced all the way back to when I first went to the cinema to see Beverly Hills Cop 3, which has no credits. at all. And I just kept waiting for the Beverly Hills Cop 3 to turn up on the screen. I was like, and then it wasn't there. So it just drove me mad. It was like the order, the sequence of the films. Just
I had a similar thing, back in the day, watching Invasion USA, the Chuck Norris film, because Chuck Norris's name does not appear in the credits at the beginning.
What?
Yeah.
That's amazing. I need
it's
to check
really that. Bizarre. Yeah.
I've taken us slightly off track there, so I apologise. But yeah, so we got Ruby Rose, Jean Reno as the villain. Tom Jolliffe made a comment on my on Facebook saying to the poster saying, "Is that Jean Reno's bored face? You know, is he bored in the movie?" And I was like, "Well, no, it's probably his collecting a paycheck face." But in all fairness, I think he does give the role a fair amount. He's quite fun in it. The environment is quite restricted, but I think, it's clearly been made on a budget, but I thought they used the space and the sets and the layouts of the rooms and that really well, especially with the stuff with the drilling the safe. So Louis Mandelor's in there as well.
Yeah.
Dan Southworth's in there. A really solid cast. And although the action is a bit choppy, at times when you can see what's going on, Ruby Rose does pretty well with it, as well as obviously stunt people.
Yeah, the action is designed to sort of, I've seen some really ridiculous comments over the years about sort of people sort of saying, oh, how unrealistic it is to sort of see a woman sort of fighting a big bloke sort of thing. And I think, well, no, actually. And I think they go out of the way to sort of design the action so that, it is pretty realistic. How she could sort of overcome the odds, and she takes a few punches as well. It's not all one sided by any means.
No, absolutely not. No, and there are nice little nods to Die Hard in the. I think she climbs down an elevator shaft and all that sort of stuff. So it knows what it is. It knows what its audience is. It's not like comical in the way it does it. It's very played very straight. But I think they get the tone. They managed the tone really well, especially with the character, because I wasn't sure how I'd feel about Ruby Rose in this role. I'm not really a fan of her, but I was kind of convinced by her action hero credentials by the end of the movie.
Steve, what do you make of the doorman?
It's like Rich said, basically it's Day Out of a Lesbian in a way. Like I said, I've only seen her in, was it John Wick 2, I think she was in?
Yes, that's right.
And I've not watched Batwoman or anything like that, so I wasn't really sure what to expect of her. But like you say, I think she does well with the action. And it is a bit over, not overblown, what's the word I'm looking for here? It's die hard with a painting. They're looking for paintings rather than the bonds and stuff, and but it does work. It's solid action. She's actually pretty damn good in it, really. Jean Reno's just, he's you sophisticated Frenchman who loves his art and his wine, and as always. But it was interesting to see Rupert Graves in there. I've not seen him in anything for ages. I think the last thing I saw him was Hellboy, to be fair, the first one.
Who did he play in it? Was he the brother, the brother-in-law?
Yes.
Bloody hell.
Rupert Evans.
Evans, sorry. Rupert Grayson,
Now you really threw me then.
Yeah, sorry.
I was thinking what? The guy at my best friend's wedding. Was he there? Robert Evans. Rupert Evans, even, yeah. Yes.
Yeah, sorry. Thanks for that.
There are a couple of sort of interesting sort of little things going on in here, like sort of her and her nephew managed to sort of sneak away and hide in this sort of secret room, which the nephew sort of quite handily sort of explains that it used to be a speakeasy during the sort of prohibition time, and it's never been touched, and he's the only person who knows it's there, and it's like all the bottles and everything are still there covered in cobwebs. He never ever thought to sort of tell anyone about it or do anything with the room. It's just like,
well, no, because he's a stoner. He doesn't drink.
That's true.
He's just a stoner.
No, but that was quite funny. The other bit I thought was quite funny was when she's having dinner with sort of the family, and she looks up, and of course they've got the skylight above the dining room table, and she goes, oh, what a wonderful view. And I'm thinking, yeah, if she doesn't there come smashing through that later on in the film, then there's something wrong here. You know, it's the Chekhov's gun kind of theory, you know. Well, now you've pointed it out to us, you've got to use it, sort of thing, which I thought was quite funny. But yeah, no, this is just good fun. It really is.
And there's some, I think there's some quite nice twists, because the characters, when she arrives, she's ex-army, she's got PTSD, she's been hooked up with this job by her relative uncle. or a friend of the family or something, and he's sort of set her up, basically, because he's trying to he's given her a job, but he's also trying to get her back together with what remains of the family that she's estranged from. I think was the main doorman at the building. He related to that guy as well? Did he say that was like his cousin or his nephew or something?
No, I can't. No, what he said was don't tell him that we're related, because it'll go easier.
Yeah. That bit lost me a little bit, because I wasn't quite, especially the way what happens between those two characters as the story develops. I wasn't quite sure whether that was his dad or something. I just lost that bit, so I wasn't quite sure. But yeah, there's stuff that happens with that character, the initial doorman, because when you first meet him, he's like, you know, sat and walking around getting changed naked in front of the girl, and you think, oh, there's something off about this guy, and that kind of pans out. I thought even the stuff with the family and the little girl and stuff, I thought it was all, you know, conventional, cliched, familiar, but well played.
It does sort of set up, you know, it sets things up quite nicely as it goes on. You know, the stuff with the, the old drawing of her that she puts on the fridge, which clues in Jean Reno's character later on as, you know, to, well, you said that you only just met her, but, you know, your daughter's drawn pictures of her from like 5 years ago or something. You know, it's little things like that. So it drops in, which is sort of quite nice. So, yeah.
There's also some moments of quite surprising violence in it. Not many, but there's a couple of bits that will make you, oh, okay. Didn't quite see that coming. Which I think is sort of something that Kitamura would have brought in. It's not got that fast-paced, frenetic kineticism of something like Versus, which is just insane.
Yeah.
But, working within a studio's boundary, I think he's crafted something above average.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the thing. The violence is quite grounded, as you say. It's not ridiculous. It's not over the top. It keeps it on a level, but it's decent. You know,
it's not PG-13 violence. It's not at all. Definitely a bit of our violence.
Yeah.
It's when we get to the sort of dare I say, mano a mano sort of fight at the end. Kitamura actually brings in, there's a camera rig that he developed when he made the film called Izumi, which sort of spins, so it goes over and above and underneath the characters in a sort of continuous circle. So we get that effect as well, which is really cool. I mean, you know, you spent all that money making a camera rig, you might as well use it often as you can. So it's very
good. I want to say there's one thing that drove me mad at the beginning of the movie before that nice cut sequence, which impressed me. So there's an opening, there's a prologue, a convoy assault scene, and I know they're sitting in cars on sets with a green screen or whatever behind them, but put your bloody seatbelts on, for heaven's sake. It's like, Jesus.
I don't know, though, because with police, they don't tend to wear their seatbelts.
Well, that little girl should have been wearing a
seatbelt. She should have been wearing a seatbelt. You're absolutely right. Yeah, I can see why her sort of security detail might not.
You know. I don't know. Maybe that is standard practice or something. But I wasn't thinking that is.
But you've got to get out of the car quickly. Fumbling with the seatbelt. I'll go with my quibble first, and that was the epilogue of the film. After all said and done, and it's kind of like, oh yeah, the family's all right. but screw you, Ruby Rose. It's like, you know, you get no clue as to what her fate is, really. You know, she's just sort of left standing on the corner. It's like, yeah, okay, well, I guess I'm out of a job. And that's basically the end of the film. It's like, what? You know?
There's kind of a,
yeah,
for me, there felt to be like a kind of a transporter kind of vibe to it, as that you could set this character up in another adventure in a new location or something.
Oh, yeah.
I think they could go down that route if they want to. It's definitely got that, you know, this could have been a Luc Besson movie easily. Mm. It's got, you know, in terms of the films that he produces for the cinema and stuff.
It would be nice if somebody actually sort of like gave the character a second shot, you know. Give it to sort of someone like Roald Reiner, or what's his name? Who's the other guy? Don Michael Paul, yeah. You know, give it to one of those guys to sort of work with. That'd be really cool.
You know who could do a really good job with this? Mm. Jesse Johnson.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, Jesse Johnson would make a great Dorman 2, I think.
A Dorman 2, or yeah. Well, that's the issue, isn't it? It's like, well, yeah, like Dorman 2, the concierge, maybe? you'd have to have her doing something completely different. So,
or maybe she'll be a cook.
Yeah, oh yeah. Yeah, she
in
also
the, in a remake of Under Siege.
Yeah. Yeah, well, Speed 2.
We made Die Hard, they might as well do Under Siege next, aren't they?
That's right, yeah. Speed 2.
Final parting thoughts was the idea of a Die Hard knockoff with a female star and an art, you know, a villain's after some art or something or other like that, I think has been done before. There was a Shannon Tweed movie, which was a sequel. She did a Die Hard movie called No Contest, which I think had Roddy Piper in it, as well as Robert Darby, I think, from Die Hard. But she did a sequel to that, which was called Face the Evil, which had Bruce Payne as the villain. And I think that was set in an art gallery.
You told me at Bruce Payne, so I'll have to try and find that.
Yeah, I think it'd be worth checking. I quite fancy checking out those films again, because that was when they were trying to, or Shannon Tweed was trying to reinvent herself as an action star and not just a softcore star. Quite interesting. The first one especially is notable. It's got Andrew Dice Clay as the villain and stuff. Ah. Yeah. Anyway, Sir Simon Ree handled the action on this one.
All right. So, yeah.
Which is pretty cool.
Absolutely.
The whole movie is really in lots of safe hands. You know, you've got good people in front of and behind the camera. It's, you know, considering Ruby Rose is not fully tested as an action lead. So,
well, as a lead, yeah, so someone actually carrying a film, you know, it's a bit of a step up.
I thought
up.
She did well. Yeah, I'm not really a fan of her. There's something, you know, I'm not particularly drawn to her as a celebrity, as a personality. But yeah, I'd watch something else with her in again after this. I enjoyed it a lot.
Cool. All right, scores on the doors, Rich.
I'm knocking it down slightly because it's so derivative. I'm going 7 out of 10.
And Steve?
Yeah, solid 7.
I think I'll join you on a 7. This is thoroughly entertaining. It's definitely worth, you know, if you're an action fan, this is one sort of worth having in your collection. It is die hard inner, as we said, you know. So there is that, which is why we're giving it a 7 rather than 8. But it's definitely worth checking out, and we definitely recommend it. That is The Dorman. Our next review is Yeti. When a scientific research party goes missing in a remote mountain region, a search team is sent out to locate them and their research, involving a recently discovered prehistoric plant which can rejuvenate cell tissue. However, there is something out in the snowy forest stalking them, and not everyone on the team are there for the same reasons. Steve, straight over to you for this one.
Absolute load of bollocks, I'm sorry, but it was... Obviously low budget. Obviously, nobody can act in it. The camera work as well was terrible. When you're in the middle of a scene and the camera's moving to get the next shot, and when it's not edited out, it just moves round. I just couldn't bear with it. I think the only thing that actually enjoyed about this was the makeup effects.
Mm.
And it, mm-hmm. that wasn't for the monster, it was more for the attacks, if you know what
yeah.
I mean.
Yeah, the gore effects.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I'm not a gore fan, as you know. Mm-hmm. But they did quite a good job of that. Everything else, no, it was terrible. I was bored to tears.
Rich, how about you? Did you get any enjoyment out of this?
Yeah, I did to a certain extent. I echo what Steve was saying with the camera work and stuff. There's a weird scene that takes place between a couple of characters outside in, because it's all taking place outside in a snowy forest.
Mm.
And they go out and they find something in the ground, like a computer yep. or something. And they're supposed to be looking at it and, oh, what's that they're doing here and whatever. You never see it. The camera stays up. It's like they were filming the scene. It was like, we actually don't have this available. So we're not actually going to show it. So it's a really odd scene because you've really got no connection with what they're doing.
Earlier on, the same two characters are talking and he's on the computer and she's stood up behind him. And literally all you can see of the guy is his forehead and his eyes. You know, they don't even get the same two characters in the same shot. Looking half decent, it's just purely amateurish, and it wound me up. It really did wind me up.
The film starts with a really nice establishing shot of a frozen landscape.
Yeah,
looks really good, but that's clearly like stock footage or something because the very next shot doesn't match it at all, and you never see anything remotely like that again because. For one thing, the scene you see before has no trees, the shot, I should say, and then everything's trees in this place. And it's just all closely shot. Could be a forest anywhere, you know, it's obviously a snowy forest, but there's one building which they see. There is one nice overhead bird's eye view shot, which I liked, but the rest of it is all very close and, you know, you don't get much of a sense of the enormity of the location they're supposed to be in, especially when they only seem to walk like 2 feet and then they're suddenly in the middle of nowhere or whatever. And then they walk back and then, you know, they've managed to get back really quickly. They seem to find each other quite easily as well. To be honest, I also got lost with some of the characters. It's a bit weird. And there's a really strange thing where one of the characters starts firing a gun it's like he's just shaking a plastic gun. There's a sound effect because they didn't put the muzzle flashes on. They do it later in the movie.
They saved it for the money shot at the end, you're right.
It's like certain parts of the film were completed to a more professional level. There's one scene where the style of the cinematography changes between shots. It's like it looks one way and then it changes to something else and it changes back again. It's like they were doing the grading and stuff or whatever or the color correction, and they just forgot what they were doing or something and got confused. So I was entertained by the practical effects. I think the creature makeup is good and the kills are quite fun, but apart from that, there's not really anything to recommend it. And it's only a 70 minute movie.
Yeah.
I like this. I'm going to qualify that statement and kind of walk it back a little bit, but no. What I did like the script. I thought the script needed a bit more polish, but it was almost there, and it needed better hands, more professional hands dealing with it.
I didn't follow any of the exposition.
No, I didn't.
I couldn't follow it. It was so unengaging. There's this big scene that happens at the beginning where the characters were talking. I'm like, look, I'm lost already. I don't even know what you're going on about. I don't know if it's the sound quality or something. I just didn't pick it up at all. Sorry.
Well, they're trying to triangulate between three different points and do this and do that. And it didn't make sense. I'll be honest. It just didn't make sense.
No, you're absolutely right. It doesn't make sense. You're right. But that's what I mean. It needed a bit more polish. But sort of the basic structure of it and the ideas were there. You know, they hadn't sort of really sort of got the mechanics totally right. But there's bits I did like. I like the fact that, you know, they're arriving. This is basically a search team, search and rescue team coming in to sort of follow up this other research team that had gone missing, gone incommunicado. There's a bit where the sort of the lead scientist switches on a answering machine. And that sort of bit that actually reminded me of Evil Dead 2 when they're playing the tape.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was actually quite good. But the film is sort of let down by its budget restraints a lot. Like I said, you know, there's bits with the gun. You know, we've talked about the film Kill Ratio before, the Simon Phillips one, where you know, they're intentionally sort of like pointing the gun off screen so that you can't even see the gun, but they've got the sound effects, you know. And it's kind of something similar there.
And the sword fight where he's supposed to have sliced him up or whatever, but there's no blood. There's nothing anywhere. There's no sign. There's no ripped clothes or, you know, slicing the... Anyway, that's a different film.
That's a totally different film. That had a really good script as well, anyway. But, yeah, I kind of liked this. And the, you know, the creature effects and the sort of kills sort of help in that regard. I like the fact that there's one really silly bit as well. And I'm watching it where this guy is reading excerpts from this guy's journal.
Mm-hmm.
And you think, and it's just this long monologue where he's sort of reading things. And I'm thinking any production worth its salt would actually just cut to the journal and let you read it, you know, or have a voiceover or something.
Yeah.
Rather than this guy sort of stilted delivery, I've got to sort of reading all this crap out. But I didn't think it was a terrible effort. I thought, you know, it definitely had entertainment value.
Can I get your thoughts on the music? Because that really stood out for me.
It did, yeah. There were bits of it which had... It reminded me of the John Carpenter's The Fog at times. So the sort of the quieter atmospheric bits actually reminded me of bits of music from The Fog.
Yeah, and also I picked up on... there seem to be little cues borrowed from like Friday the 13th and the Halloween films and stuff like that. I think the composer, Matt Jansen, has done tons of credits. And when I was watching this, I was thinking, is this library music? You know, have they bought in some bits of music and just added them in? Because they don't fit. They don't fit the movie. The music is quite epic at times and it doesn't...
It's Night of the Running Man all over again, isn't it?
It really stands out, and it's self-consciously so, and it was making me think, well, does this guy write music and sell it via a website to anybody to use in their films and stuff? It doesn't seem that that's the case. It seems that it was music for the film, but that's as much as I can find out. It's very odd. There's a definite disconnect between the quality of the music. I mean, there's a big swell of, you know, sort of exciting music over the credits, which are quite well done. And say the kill music, the music for the kills, I thought was quite good. So the music is definitely standout, but the rest of the production just doesn't match it. Another thing I just want to mention on the end about it being a sort of half completed or, you know, semi-incomplete movie. The end credits, it says cast, and, you know, obviously then it's the character names and who they're played by. But there's a bit there above it, and it says structured for story.
Yes.
And I think that's like a template thing that they didn't delete. It's structured for story. So we put the list in as they appeared in the movie,
rather than
alphabetical order or something. And they didn't delete it. that can be the only thing, because why else would it say that?
Yeah, Rich. Now you mentioned the credits, and I know you're a stickler for sort of watching credits to the end. Did you see the final message on there?
Oh,
about the promised sequel.
Yes.
Called Revenge of the Mummy,
mm-hmm.
or something along those lines.
Well, I'll tell you what, this also...
Definitely the Mummy.
I'll tell you what that is. I think they copied the credits as a template from a previous film that the company made called The Mummy Rebirth.
Holy crap, that'd be... Oh, God, that is so funny.
See why it makes sense? I haven't seen The Mummy Rebirth, so I can't say if that's on there, but seem to be really a good explanation of it.
I mean, everyone's guilty of copy and pasting and maybe not being vigilant enough to sort of, just sort of change bits, but that is hilarious. So that's true, if that's what it is.
It would make sense. Looking into it.
Well, it's
50-50. If it is that company, that's clearly what they're referring to, a sequel to that Mummy film. Yeah. And if they copied it, that would make sense. Because why else would you mention
It's 50-50, a completely isn't different it? Movie? Yeah. Either they've made making a sequel with a completely wrong monster, which would just be hilarious in itself, or they've copied and pasted the credits from another film and then hadn't been sort of like vigilant enough to sort of go through and sort of find the bits they need to take out.
I'll be honest, the second one seems to me is what they've done. I mean, like I say, it just seems very, the whole thing seems very amateurish, I'll be honest.
I did think really it was like an asylum movie, but it's not. It's made by a company called Picture Zero Entertainment. It does at times. I mean, in terms of the casting and the setting and the way it's filmed and stuff, it does feel very asylum. I think in all fairness, I think the asylum probably wouldn't have done as good a job with the monster and the death scenes. So in that way, it's better than an asylum movie. But apart from that, not. The other interesting thing I spotted in the credits was, I presume the film was shot in Canada or something.
Right.
Again, although they never show it, but they actually shot it in Poland. And not only that, they also shot in Russia. So this is a production that went across two countries or two continents, even maybe. I don't know. It's like,
that's crazy.
There's no justification in the final film product that we watched, I think, that would justify the filming in two locations.
You went that far, and yet you didn't have enough money for decent sort of gun sound effects or muzzle flashes, which would have really elevated your film. You know, it would because they stand out a mile to anyone watching this sort of thing.
The director of this film, which is originally called Abominable. I mean, not sure on the screen, even on the screener, it has the original title Abominable. I'm not sure if people pick it up in the supermarket or whatever, whether it still says that. But it's directed by a guy called Jamal Burden. He did a film called The Elves prior to this, which has also had terrible reviews. I don't have much hope for his next production, to be honest.
Well, hopefully you'll spend a bit of time going through the credits on this next film. Maybe we're being harsh. Maybe the stakeholders are sort of like rushing this through, saying, no, you've got to get on the shelves quickly, get it out there. And he hasn't, literally hasn't got time, or people haven't got time to, what am I talking about? Yeah, of course they do. Anyway, scores on the doors for Yeti. So I'm going to give it a 5 out of 10.
I'll go 4.
And Rich?
Yeah, I think some of the bad stuff is quite amusing, and also the practical suit effects and CGI, the lack of CGI, the fact that they've gone for practical effects by a guy called Joe Castro. I think that warrants, that's good. That takes it up a couple of points. So I'm going to go 4 as well.
And that's the good version of your.
Yeah.
Okay, two 4s and a 5 for Yeti. Our next review is 12 Hour Shift. Nurse Mandy is not having a good day, being lumbered with a 12-hour shift on duty at the local hospital in Arkansas. She and her boss have a sideline in selling organs on the black market, but when their courier, who happens to be Mandy's cousin, messes up and loses the delivery, the bad luck and mayhem starts to snowball out of control. So this was a festival darling from last year. Got talked about quite a bit, things like Fright Fest and TIFF and places like that. I really enjoyed this. It is the characters make this work, I think, especially the cousin Regina, who is just a monumental fuck up. I mean, really, it's just absolutely hilarious. She picks up this. Well, she doesn't pick up this consignment of organs, and then spends an in indeterminate amount of time just fucking around before actually delivering them, like hours later. It is absolutely hilarious. I'll talk about this more in a minute, but over to Rich.
Yeah, it's definitely not what I was expecting, because the poster kind of sets it up as, you know, horror movie in a hospital, David Arquette looming in the background and that. And it's very much a indie movie. And I'll tell you what it brought to mind. The Robbery, the Jim Cummings short film.
Yes.
It's especially with, as you say, with this character of Regina, played by Chloe Farnworth, who's actually from Herefordshire.
Really? She did a really good accent.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah. So she's very notable. So clearly deranged character. Is she deranged or is she just so stupid?
But just so stupid. Every teacher had already told her she's stupid.
You know, she's murderous. She has no qualms about whether that's because she's missing a screw or something. I don't know, but she's definitely crazy.
Sociopath, yes.
Yeah, sociopath. That's the word I was looking for. But the lead actress, it starts out with this very slow shot and somebody else sort of talking over in voiceover, and it turns out they're having a conversation. It's Angela Bettis, who's a star of many an indie.
The woman, favorite, most notably.
The woman, Lucky, was it? She was in. Was that from Lucky? May, sorry, I'm thinking of May. Lucky McKee. So, yeah, David Arquette is in there, but he's almost misdirection.
Yeah.
You can't expect more to happen with him than actually does. What I liked about probably the first half or so of the film is it's very focused on female characters. The three of them. Angela Bettis' nurse Mandy, who's a reprobate drug addict, sort of basically killing people in the hospital to get the organs and passing them on to Regina with the help of shift overseer or something. I don't know what her particular role is, but so they're all working together to work on that, and really unappealing. This is, you know, it's a bad people doing bad things movie. The last thing like this, I would say, was Silent Night that we covered. Or, you know, you could equate it with any gangster movie and stuff. But it's got a very distinctive kind of. It's very much an indie take on a crime film. You know, so it's really it's quite unpredictable. Weird stuff happening. It's very black. It's a black comedy. Very black. Lots of lots of humor and stuff in it. I didn't love it probably as much as you did, but I was intrigued and interested in what's got. There's a nice cameo by a professional wrestler
Mick Foley. Nice to see him.
That was really unexpected. The film could have gone in lots of different directions, and it kind of keeps you guessing as to where it's going to go. And I think the way it all pans out is in keeping with the kind of film that it is and its origins, but it's definitely not a straight horror movie that, you know, like if it's got like Fright Fest or whatever, you're gonna think, oh, it's gonna be like a gore fest or something. It's really not that at all. It's there's a musical sequence where one of the characters sort of starts singing a song, and then it cuts to another unrelated character who's sitting around, who just starts dancing around and singing and stuff. It turns into Southland Tales or something. It's got that sort of really real quirkiness about it.
Steve, what do you reckon of this one?
Yeah, like I said, it's more like a black farce more than a horror to me. It's just, you know, building and building and building, and what could go wrong does go wrong, and then bodies start piling up and stuff like that. No, but it's enjoyable. It's again, I don't think I loved it quite as much as you, Mike. I'm probably more on the same lines as Rich, but again, misdirection. David Arquette, I think he's in it for about 30 seconds.
He gets various scenes. He sort of pops in and out.
But he's like on the poster. But that helps when you produce the film. You can do that, I presume. It's very, very quirky, very indie, very. There isn't anyone to root for, really, because they're all kind of
scumbags.
Yeah, they're all kind of like a Midwest scumbag town where everyone just fucks each other over all the time, you know, something like some sort of Breaking Bad or something along them lines. But very sharply written script, filmed really well. I think, is it, she called a comedian, is it, you know, I think it's the first directing job.
What, Bray Grant?
She's done. Bray Grant, that's it, yeah. And I think she did a really, really good job with it, really. And the ending, well, it's quite open as well, which I enjoyed.
Yeah, I mean, the ending as well, you know, that bit at the end when she leaves, you know, end of her shift, it just sort of shows the bleakness of her character and her, you know, that sort of life that she's in. And you can sort of sympathize up to a point, you know, organ harvesting element she doesn't necessarily murder people, as she says, you know, she just
she picks the ones who are going to die and just kills them a bit earlier, yeah, you know,
yeah, doesn't report it down their throats like bloody Regina.
No.
Looking so bloody pleased with herself. But I like the script. I like the way it sort of, you know, it sets up the dominoes basically, and then you get to a point where you just need to sort of like touch one and everything's going to go, you know. You know, you've got so many different elements. You've got her, you know, her overdose brother. You got the, you know, this convicted cop killer who's there for some reason. Various other characters, Regina herself, you know, this fucking nonce guy who make phony sense to get, you know, to get Regina back, and he's got the most god awful bloody rat tail ponytail. You know, he's got like you know, a shaved head almost. Sort of like a number two sort of shaved head, and then this fucking rat tail which goes like all the way down his back. It's like, my Jesus Christ! Do you know what this film actually reminded me of the most? It was actually the film called Arkansas.
Well, that would be apt because...
It would be apt because it's set in Arkansas. Exactly. Yeah, yeah, Arkansas is not a fucking place you want to visit. That's what these films are telling me. You know, do not go to Arkansas for any reason.
Did you, just to sort of pick up on a couple of points there, did you watch all the way through the credits? Because the credits run while the film doesn't actually cut away. It's quite refreshing because it kind of has a post-credits or mid-credits scene. But it doesn't fade to black and come back. It's kind of like, well, if you're waiting around and you're watching the credits or whatever, you know the story does continue just that little step.
I saw who went into the hospital sort of thing.
Yeah, so yeah. I thought that was quite good. And you interpret what you think of as of that's going to be.
But that also brings. I mean, we kind of mentioned this before about films which. I think, it was bloody Legacy of Lies, where they, you know, the filmmakers just want to sort of push past the happily ever after bit. Mm-hmm. You know, somebody once wrote that, you know, happy endings only happen because that's when the storyteller decided to stop the story. The Princess Bride has a classic example, you know, in that where it says that everything's happy ever after until that guy's stitches came undone and, you know, he bled to death and all this sort of stuff. And there's been quite a few examples recently, like Legacy of Lies, that film, The Second, which is now on Netflix with Ryan Phillippe.
Have you watched that?
I have, yeah.
Oh, because I was hoping to cover that in a future episode.
Okay, well, yeah, we could do Casarandias and that. But again, it's that thing. It's like, well, that's the traditional ending, but we're going to sort of push it that little bit further. And that's that sort of scenario here. It's like, you know, it ends on a much more sort of, it's ambiguous, but sort of darkly ambiguous, the way it ends, you know.
Yeah, but like you say, it just shows how bleak her life is, you know. It's just daily grind, you know. To think that a nurse, I don't want to spoil it, but to do what she does right at the end, and then to have it carry on like that, it just shows the grind.
Yeah, no wonder she's doing drugs, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
There is no way she would not be doing drugs in that situation, I don't think.
Yeah.
But yes. So any other comments for 12-hour shift?
Why is it set in 1999?
To get rid of the mobile phones.
Do you think? Okay.
Yeah. That's this film would be over in seconds if they had mobile phones.
Oh, fair enough. Okay. Yeah. I see what you're
Yeah, if Regina went back to Mick Foley and went, oh no, I don't have the thing, hang on a minute, I'll call Mandy. Mandy, I forgot the thing, and she'd go and find it. Maybe.
But they could have gone to a payphone to do that.
Yeah, but it'd still be convoluted.
The
other thing I wanted to flag up was, again, one of the things that really highlights the indie-ness of the movie is the soundtrack, which is like this beatnik jazz kind of...
Yeah, lots of drum beats, yeah. Mm. Yeah.
What did you think? How did you feel that complemented the...
I quite liked it for a lot of it, yeah. Yeah, it did give it a sort of... Yeah, it did, I think. It sort of almost gave it like a heist kind of feel as well, sort of like Ocean's 11 kind of thing, you know. But
Ocean's Always. Yeah,
with these that's incredible, what I mean. Incredible.
When I say like a black farce, you know, it did help with it, to be honest, the soundtrack.
Yeah. Scores on the doors, gentlemen.
I like this. I'm going to give it a 7 out of 10.
I think I'd give it a 6. Like I said, just not quite as much as you, Mike.
Mm-hmm. I'll be honest, I think there's a lot that's really interesting about it, but I'm going to go 6 as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, 2 sixes and a 7 for 12-hour shift. Our short shot this week is Ready. A kidnapped for ransom mercenaries find their operation disrupted when Officer Martin is sent in to rescue one of their captives. Okay, so this one features a gang of about sort of 5 mercenaries who kidnap young ladies who are wealthy or come from wealthy backgrounds, hold them for ransom, and if they don't pay, they basically sort of hunt them down for sport. A young policewoman is selected to follow up a lead and try and rescue the latest victim, and things don't go as planned. This is probably one of the more violent films of this like that we've seen, Rich.
Yeah, I really liked it. It's 11 minutes long, including credits. And it's a nice, although open-ended, I think it's a nice beginning, middle, you know, a proper short film as a beginning, middle, structure. And an end. Yeah, yeah. It's a well-structured story. You know where you stand at each point in it. I think the ending, although it's open, I think that's more of a suspenseful thing. I think it's just sort of, you know where it's going. Mm. Kind of, you know where you've been left. The action is... not as well handled as I would like, but I couldn't really fault it too much. I mean, this isn't something that's come from a group of, you know, action filmmakers who we know, like Jean-Paul Lee or something like that. This is made by writer and director Nicholas Winter, who does generally feature length horror movies, which I haven't really seen a lot of, but I think things like A Dark Path were some of his, and House of Shadows were his most recent thing. So this was quite a nice surprise to see him do an action film and to find it worked so well. The main characters, played by, Jake Colucci playing the really nasty leader of the kidnapping ring, and Lucy Arden, I think, plays the detective. Or investigator who's sent in to, you know, do the mission, or what, you know, whatever position it is that she holds, I can't remember, but she's sent in, and I think it plays out really well. How did you guys get on with it?
Yeah, I agree. I thought this was very good. As I said, this is probably one of the more sort of violent and vicious films of this ilk that we've seen. You know, these mercenaries do not pull any punches. you know, even sort of the mission, you know, goes wrong in quite interesting fashion. I thought it worked really well.
I could easily see a Zara Fithian, you know, in this, you know, so it's, they could, you could make this a longer story, but I don't think it needed to be. I mean, we've seen films like this before, and I think the way it has been done is good enough as a standalone project. Sorry, Steve. Mm.
Yeah, I agree with you, Mike. Really, it was, quite nasty, quite violent, but done on the more rough and ready side rather than the polished.
Yeah,
you know, but it worked well, and that little slight twist at the end made it just a little bit more interesting rather than just, you know, your normal standard kidnapper mercenary going in, kicking the hell out of him, rescuing whoever, and the normal standard fare, really. But yeah, it was done well. I didn't particularly like the bad woman. I thought she was a little bit, slightly hammy for, you know, what she was doing. But yeah, it was okay.
Interesting. I did actually review one of his previous films, The Robin Hood, The Rebellion.
Yes.
Which I thought was actually pretty good, except in the action department.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yes. Yeah, so that, you know, the film itself is actually pretty decent.
Because that's Die Hard in a castle.
It is kind of, yeah. And it does have Martin Ford in it as well for like one decent scene. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I quite like that. I just wish they, you know, could have done something more with the fight scenes in that particular film. But, you know, maybe you can sort of redo those scenes with these people. Who knows? But yeah, this is pretty good. 6 minutes, as we said, definitely worth checking out.
Yeah, so it's on Prime.
Yes, rather than YouTube, it's on Prime. Our DTV throwback this week is The Cold Light of Day. I have to emphasize the at the beginning of that, because there's another film called Cold Light of Day, which is the Henry Cavill and Bruce Willis remake of Target, which starred Gene Hackman and Matt Dillon back in the day. Anyway, I digress. So in this one, in an unspecified ex-USSR country, police detective Victor Marek fights to learn the truth behind a series of child murders, despite his superiors forcing a confession out of a scapegoat. When Marek befriends a single mother and her young daughter, he decides to use the girl as bait. So this stars Richard E. Grant.
Mm-hmm.
Quite young Richard E. Grant. So this is what, 96, I believe?
96,
So he's this detective. He's from the city. He's in the country, which has seen some political turmoil and upheaval in the past. And there's sort of been a change of the old guard. But some of these sort of the old ways are still in use, like just beating a confession out of it, whoever's sort of useful at the time. So there's been these three murders of these young girls, and they've got a sort of likely suspect, but it's obviously not him. And, you know, sort of Richard E. Grant's character sort of butts heads as he goes on. So this is a very sort of handsomely made film. It's got some dubious elements for sure. But I'm just so surprised I'd never ever heard of it. Rich, where did you dig this up from?
This was a film that had a very quiet release by Polygram on video in, say, 1996. And when I saw it then, and I don't think I've found it anywhere since. And now it just
turns up on Netflix.
It just turns up, which is the strangest place you would expect to find it, because Netflix is rubbish for old movies.
It is. This is probably one of the oldest films on Netflix.
So I've been wanting to see this film for ages, and the place I would have expected it to turn up would have been Prime.
Yeah.
But it's haunted me ever since I saw it. And, you know, I've always wanted to revisit it. It's a very different film to what Richard E. Grant is known for, certainly nowadays. And when I saw it, I was only young. I didn't have the knowledge that I have now. And we didn't have the internet. And also, you know, it might have been mentioned in Empire magazine or something. That would have been about it. Mm. And there was just something unique about it. And I don't think I even necessarily picked up on the European setting, because all the cast is English. Mm. Or not all the cast, but, you know, a lot of the cast is English. And it's, you know, speaking English. Any of the supporting actors who are European are speaking English. So you could easily just think of it that way. But it's got a very distinctive landscape. And it's filled with people like Richard E. Grant. It's filled with familiar faces that you would recognise from other places. Oddly, mainly people from sitcoms. So it's got this really weird thing of like seeing people that you recognise or might not necessarily know where you've seen them from, but you think, oh, I know that guy, and it's from a comedy, and this is very much not a comedy.
Now, do you know what that comment reminds me of, that what you've just said there? And mm-hmm. that coupled with the fact that, you know, it's set in a sort of USSR country, yet everyone's speaking English in the film, it reminded me of another film in that regard, and that was Gorky Park.
Oh, yeah. Well, there was also Child 44 recently with... Yeah.
Well, that Tom was packed Hardy. Full of sitcom artists as well, was it?
Well, no, that wasn't packed full of sitcom artists. Yeah. But I haven't seen Gorky Park, so tell me about...
You never seen Gorky Park? But, I mean, no, in small roles, you've got like the likes of Alexei Sale turns up.
Oh, okay.
And also, what was that one about the antique dealer? Something...
Lovejoy.
Lovejoy, yeah, he's in it.
Oh, Ian McShane, yeah.
No, not... Oh. What's the other one I'm thinking of? Oh, I'm going to have to cut all this out now.
Right. I get where you're coming from. So So did you reckon? So we've got basically a guy from Bottom. There's this guy with a bald pate and a moustache. If you saw him, you'd think, I've seen him in loads of stuff, but he's never been sort of a headline actor. He's appeared in shows like Bottom and stuff over the years. And then the guy playing the serial killer, because that's what this is, a serial killer movie. Yeah. He's from Heidi High.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, bloody! I knew him. Yeah.
Oh yeah. As soon as I saw him, I'm like, Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
Yeah. Simon Cadell from Heidi High, but I didn't know. And funnily enough, he died shortly after making this film. It's one of his last credits.
Yeah, I remember that. Remember him passing away. Yeah.
So this weird casting, as well as this other guy who's he works in the mental hospital, and is helping Richard E. Grant's Marek. With the case, who I just kept thinking, is that Leo Sayer? but it's not. It's not Leo Sayer. It's a guy called Heathcote Williams.
Yeah.
And he's quite, you know, got a distinct presence and stuff. But anyway, the casting aside, I think just the film itself has got quite a haunting story, especially coming at it years later as a parent. You know, you see it in a completely different way.
Well, you know, and speaking of sort of seeing it in a different light, way. I mean, you could easily see Richard E. Grant's character being sort of, you know, strung up as a paedophile in this film. The way he obsesses over the girl, you know, there's a bit where he's sat with the girl's mother and have this conversation, and his eyes are just completely on the girl all the time. And even when the mother's sort of saying, I've got very sensitive nipples, you know, you might want to sort of try them out in the morning. And he's just going, you know, because it just doesn't register at all, you know, and someone could really sort of like misread his intentions in that film, I think.
Well, his intentions are pretty bad anyway. Steve, fill us in on what his motivations are and what he's doing in the movie.
He's basically saying the killer's got a type, basically. Mm. Young, blonde girl. And he's basically setting her up as bait. He bumps into her in the forest and he takes her home where her mum lives in this train carriage.
I think it's like
a train carriage.
Mm.
And then she works in this factory. Then decides to rent out a petrol station. Get her.
How'd you do?
Yeah. Because it works out the killer uses this road. Excuse me. Rents out a petrol station and just sticks her on the road as bait for the killer. I mean, you know, it'd work it does work, obviously, but it's then he decides to get involved with the mother, and then when she finds out that he's using the daughter's bait, they still carry on and get together. But I must admit, I thought Richard E. Grant was really, really good in this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, normally he's your quite camp, affable, lovely type of guy. He's a miserable bastard in this, but I think it works really, really, really well. I think he's great in it. I mean, obviously Simon Cadell's, you know, he's a bit over the top with, basically he's trying to regress to childhood, you know, keep the girls as young. He's like a dummy. He's like an avatar of the girls he's killed and has parties with them and shaves his pubes so he's still young and stuff like that. And but I just really enjoyed it. I thought it was great.
Yeah, thoroughly enjoyable. Well, not enjoyable, but thoroughly compelling.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm glad you guys liked it. Did you feel like you'd seen it before?
No, not really. No.
Well, you might not have seen the movie that I'm going to mention now. Sean Penn made a film with Jack Nicholson called The Pledge in 2001.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Which was based on the same source novel. As this film. So when I went to see that film, I was thinking, hang on a minute, this is The Cold Light of Day. It's the same. Right, it's the same movie, but you know, done in a different way. So I thought that was quite interesting. And Will at Exploding Helicopter was asking for recommendations, and I gave him this one. And he did point out to me that there was actually another version preceding this one in I think it was the late 50s in Germany, because it's based on a German novel. So there's actually been three different takes on this, which is interesting. But the Jack Nicholson one just didn't click with me at all. I didn't. It had a good, really good cast and everything, but this film, it just really stuck with me. And especially as one of those formative years sort of DTV movies that I encountered, I've never forgotten it. And I was really pleased that it stands up so well. One of the things that seeing it all these years later didn't sort of jarred a bit with me is that perhaps the film didn't have the courage of its convictions with regard to how it all plays out. I don't know about the novel, but there's very much a Hollywood ending feel to the whole proceeding in the final act, especially with, you know, Richard E. Grant, you know, setting this family up. You know, it's really bad, and really he should not get away with that at all. So I thought maybe that was a slight misstep. I still like it, and I still think it's a very, very strong movie. But that just sort of jarred a little bit. The film was made, I believe, in Czechoslovakia, and I think that's where it's supposed to be set, although for some reason they don't want to stress it. A lot of the supporting actors are Czech. It's directed by a Dutchman. It's a very European production. So they've gone for this very rural, you know, poor, you know, impoverished and tormented, village. Yeah. And there's a lot of corruption. I think the first half of the first act of the movie where Marek is struggling with the remnants of the old guard and their methods, you know, and he's trying to save that, the son of a teacher. I think it's a teacher of his or an instructor. Right.
Yeah,
and he's trying and it just doesn't work. And that's why he goes out on his own. But then he kind of becomes a bad guy himself, but the film doesn't have the courage to make him, you know, to take it all the way. And they kind of keep him as a heroic character, even though the stuff he's doing is pretty awful.
There's a bit towards the end which I missed. I was out of the room for a second. I didn't have time to sort of rewind it. Where he gets picked up by the police, and I couldn't work out why they suddenly turned up.
They basically just turn up.
All right.
Well, because you know he had he was asking for the help of the psychiatrist, and he said, "I don't want no part of this." Basically, he's gone and he's gone and told them.
Oh, I see.
And and they've come after him because they see him as naturally he is a threat, and you know, taking him away would have been completely the right thing to do. But unfortunately, by that point in the story, something else even worse is about to happen.
Yeah.
And that's where I say that the film sort of wraps things up just a bit too neatly. It gets very hairy at times.
It does lead to a very good car flipping over.
Yeah, you get a nice car flip.
You get a nice car flip. Now, just to go back to my early point about Gorky Park, okay, the actor I was thinking of was Michael Elphick from Boone.
Oh, yeah.
Not Lovejoy, that's the other one. Yeah, Boone. But yeah, I'm surprised you haven't seen Gorky Park, actually, Rich.
No, I think I know of it. I've heard of it, but I don't really... I think because Cold War and all that kind of stuff never really was something that really appealed to me. So I think I'd watch it now, but I've never
watched
it. The... I thought what you were saying earlier about the Bruce Willis movie being a remake of an old Matt Dillon movie.
Yeah.
I didn't know that at all. That's interested me. I don't think I've ever seen Target either. Coming back to Cold Light Day, the young girl, the actress who plays Perdita, what's that? Is it Anna?
Anna.
I don't know if you checked up on this, but...
Well, the name did ring a bell,
She's a Welsh actress, and she plays Higgins in Magnum PI, the new version.
Oh, all right. Yeah.
So she's very famous now in America. I think they're on 3 seasons, I think.
I saw like the pilot episode and I hated it.
Yeah, I watched it and I wasn't overly struck. But you know what it's like with those things. They have to bed in, don't they?
I thought that had died a death. I really did.
No.
I thought it'd gone the way of the reboot of Knight Rider and... all that sort of crap.
At the moment it's still do quite. She was in a film called As Above, So Below.
Yes, that's a good. It is good.
She's got tons and tons of credits to her name. So she's had an incredible career following this movie, including Spice World when she was younger. I thought that was really interesting to find that this young actress has gone on to this. You know, because I remember Higgins the original from the Tom Selleck version.
Well, of course.
So just to see that's happened. But Richard E. Grant he's had a few, notable films recently. I think he did one with Melissa McCarthy that got quite good notices.
He got the Oscar nom for that.
Yeah, and so I haven't really seen that. And I've always been a fan of Skywalker.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, he had a small role in that Star Wars, yeah. But I remember him only from like Hudson Hawk and stuff like that, where he was, him really camping up, with Northern Eye is like his defining character.
Well, as a shout out to our next episode, the first film I saw him in was Warlock.
Right, it was.
I actually went to see that at the cinema as well. So, yeah, that was my sort of first Richard E. Grant take.
If you've seen Richard E. Grant in Hudson Hawk or whatever, and then like I did, and then you go back and watch Warlock, that's a very different film, very different Richard E. Grant. You know, it's not the kind of film you can't imagine him in it now. It's just not the kind of thing you would see him put into.
Now, here's a confession as well from me. I've never seen With Nail and I.
Neither have I. I've never fancied it. I just don't fancy it.
Yeah.
No.
Here's a confession from me. I have seen it, but I don't think it's all that. It's just not. It's not my cup of tea. It's not. Not really. It was one of those films that was very. It's a cult movie. It was very big in, it had a rebirth, a cult rebirth in like the mid to late 90s.
College student's darling film, that was, that sort of thing.
I wasn't overstruck. But he is a very memorable presence. I haven't watched it since I was a kid or whatever, but I might like it now. I don't know, but I wasn't bothered, I wasn't fussed. But this, for me, this is Richard E. Grant's best film that I've seen in. Cool. And best character, best performance. I think he's really solid.
No, I'm sticking with Warlock. Anyway, any more comments about The Cold Light of Day? Otherwise, we'll wrap up.
I'll mention the guy from Bottom that I mentioned was Roger Sloman, I think was his name. So he popped up in all sorts of stuff. And what was the other thing? I just wrote about it. Marek's foolishness is motivated by an almost insane need to stop the killer. And I think there was a film John Turturro did called Fear X, which I saw a long time ago. And I think it could have really gone down that kind of dark, you know, how far would you be willing to go, and would you lose yourself completely? I think that's the kind of mission that he sort of seems on at the start of the film. And by the end of the movie, they kind of go, now let's have a, let's polish it off nicely. So that takes the edge off slightly for me. But apart from that, it's a Stone Cold classic as far as I'm concerned.
Another film that sort of like reminded me of a little bit was Jennifer 8.
Oh, the Andy Garcia.
Yeah.
And Uma Thurman one. Yeah. So similar sort of thing where he focuses on this woman who fits the type of the killer in the hope that he can draw him out. Okay, so this has turned up on Netflix, of all places, as we said. I mean, Netflix isn't known for showing anything that's more than sort of 20 years old on its platform. So, for such an obscure film to suddenly just bubble to the surface is bizarre for Netflix.
The cold light of day has finally seen the light of day.
Yeah. Now, as we mentioned at the top of this review, there is obviously another film called Cold Light of Day, which stars Henry Cavill and Bruce Willis. Very different kind of film, but quite enjoyable in its own right. But this definitely worth seeking out. So we'll put the trailer in the footnotes, as we usually do, as well as the short that we covered this week, which was Ready, and the trailers for the other films as well. So just down to me to thank Rich and Steve for joining me again this week.
No problem.
No problem at all.
Awesome, and Happy New Year, everyone. And tune in next time. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the DTV Digest. Let us know your thoughts in the comments and tune in again next time.